Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're sharing our favorite songs defined by backing vocals. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll get to our favorite backing vocals, but first we have two albums to review.
Who let the dope boys out? Thank God you let me crash on your couch. Who's my God that I'm praying to now? Early 2000s, they try to jump me in, Latino protection. Any direction, you gave me your blessing. Texting, I text them, I told them I got them. Told them I made it to Hollywood. All that took.
Platinum record, not gonna keep my black ass out of jail.
That is a little bit of Buzz Cut, the opening track from the new Brockhampton album, Roadrunner, or Greg, to give it its full title, Roadrunner, New Light, New Machine. As a couple of weeks ago, with King Lizard, Grizzard, Wizard, we've been remiss in dealing with the pop culture, sociological, and music phenomenon known as Brockhampton. Surprisingly long story for this self-described boy band. Working in the hip-hop realm primarily with a lot of pop and R&B, almost jokingly using that phrase, boy band. How many members of Brockhampton? Well, there's generally six in a lot of photos, but they really count it as up to 13, including their manager, photographer, web designer. This posse, another word they use, came together in San Marcos, Texas in 2010.
Hip-hop hotbed, Jim.
Hip-hop hotbed of San Marcos, Texas. Some of them knew each other from high school. Were initially a group called Alive Since Forever. Rebranded, a word they use, themselves as Brockhampton in 2014, first mixtape 2016, and they have been pretty prolific ever since. Really got on the map, I think, with the three, count them, one, two, three studio albums that came within a six-month period of 2017. Saturation, Saturation 2, and Saturation 3. They are now up to album number 6, Roadrunner. We're going to play a track, and because this is as much a let's examine this phenomenon as an album review, we're going to have some help from their target demographic. I don't think I've read any group since about 1966 in interviews use the words youth culture as often as the members of Brockhampton. So we have a member of the youth culture, our Columbia College intern, Sol Delgadillo, to help us out. But first, let's play a track.
When I look at myself, I see a broken man. Remnants of my pops, put the Glock to his head. Nothing ever go as planned, couldn't make amends. Forcibly pretend I don't give a damn. At a loss, aimless, 6 feet deep, suffocating. Can't face it, can't change it, ain't make it. Master plans by the maker, I see no savior. Mortal reflection is stainless steel. Alcohol and pills, deadly combination. Left with nothing else to feel, a floral haven. Hope it was painless, I see you in the faces. Places, am I making? Reflections off a broken mirror. Fragments of my fear, glaring back like who's there.
All right, that is a little bit of the light from Roadrunner, the new album from Brockhampton. As promised earlier, we're enlisting our Columbia College intern, Sol Delgadillo, has been working with us as a producer. Were you a fan before the new album?
Yeah, I was definitely a fan of Brockhampton before this album came out. I got into them right as Saturation 1 dropped, and then they later released Saturation 2, Saturation 3, and that's what sort of built their core fan base, and they just continually made music. If you weren't already a fan of them, it was hard for you to sort of keep up with the later albums that came out after that, like Iridescence and Ginger. Iridescence was one of those albums that it was very experimental, and it felt weird after Saturations 1 through 3 because they had lost a member. A member had gotten kicked out.
Yeah, because of charges of sexual harassment.
Exactly.
Whereas these guys are woke. right? Mm-hmm. They do not want to be seen as sexist. And they have been talking about, you know, political issues and the leader of the group, to the extent that there is one person that we can finger as the leader. Kevin Abstract, a.k.a. Ian Simpson, has come out as gay, which still takes tremendous amount of courage in the hip-hop world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, being black, being gay, and being in a boy band really just does it for you. And you sort of have to, you know, combat all those stereotypes that, you know, just because I'm black, just because I'm gay, doesn't mean that I can't make good music.
Right, right. My issue with them was I thought they were trying to do too much in their songs. They were just all, you know... You never felt like there's a song here. There's just a whole bunch of ideas being smashed together.
Yeah, this album is more focused, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. This one, like, you can definitely tell the fact that they disappeared for a year and some change definitely shows, like, growth and how calculated every song feels. And although it feels calculated, it was just what one of the members needed during this time. His name's Joba. You know, when an artist experiences a loss, their first instinct is to use their art to heal and to find a way to cope.
Yeah, and his father committed suicide. He is trying to find hope. The light is worth the wait, I promise.
The light is worth the wait, I promise. Wait, why did you do it? The light is worth the wait, I promise. Wait, screaming, please don't do it.
It's an extraordinary track, and whenever he comes front and center to the mic, he really demands your attention on this album. And I think so, too, does Kevin Abstract. I mean, when Abstract is talking about the struggle to tell his mother, who he loved, to come out as a gay man, and that line that kills me, I only take the Jeep out if my boyfriend's driving. He's got the kind of skin that makes police like him.
No peace in my streets, and these days no license. Only take the Jeep if my boyfriend is driving. Plus he got the kind of skin that make the police like him. Ever since I was a kid, I always felt so frightened.
You know, he's talking, I can't drive my own Jeep as a successful black man because I might get pulled over. Right? Really powerful. And then there's other stuff, Soul. A lot of use of the N-word gratuitously, I think, and mm-hmm. the B-word gratuitously, I think.
I mean, the flip side of what Jim was talking about, where there is some kind of like, you know, those cliches, those hip-hop cliches, you know, there's a vulnerability too. And, you know, like that, there's that one hymn, Dear Lord, you know, it's flat out a church hymn.
So God bless you, love. Healing with your light, praying all the time, tears showing to the light.
And it's a prayer for his friend, right?
Yeah, basically, because they touch on all these topics, especially because, at least in Catholicism, when somebody commits suicide, they're basically in purgatory for the rest of their like soul's life. And so I think that track in particular is sort of saying a prayer like, hey, you know, we're not religious by any means, but for those who are, this is a prayer and this is how we're dealing with it, how we're coping, how we want Joba to heal and bounce back from this.
I think they're incredibly smart listeners of the entire musical spectrum. Like, dare I say, many Sound Opinions listeners are. And they are all hanging out together, having a grand time, and seeing if they can throw everything into the gumbo.
Just to wrap up from my end, Soul, that was well done. I appreciate your perspective. I think the fact that you were skeptical about this record and it sort of turned you around, I feel the same way in a lot of ways. I feel like these young people are growing into artists who potentially could have some longevity. Yeah, I feel definitely. like somebody like Kevin Abstract could have an incredible long-lived career as an artist. I feel like that's where they're going, you know, especially him.
And I appreciate you guys having me and like hearing me out on my end on this album.
You know the Sound Opinions mantra, Soul. Everybody's a critic. Thank you for giving us your thoughts.
I'm feeling so blessed. The rest I've lately regressed, but the tones are unfazed. Nazi hums. Where are my old chums? The scattered alums, not cut, but since grazed.
That is a track called Since Grazed, the title track from the new 11th Dream Day album. Yes, a new 11th Dream Day album. This band has been going strong since the 80s. Their first full-length studio record since Works for Tomorrow in 2015, so it's been quite a break. This is typical of this band. They don't necessarily make a ton of records, but the ones they do make are very good. It's a double album, gatefold sleeve, the whole works. It's classic, old-school, beautiful presentation, beautiful packaging, and the music inside. We're going to talk about that in a bit. But this band, the core of it is the songwriter and guitarist and singer Rick Rizzo and drummer Janet Bean, who also does backing vocals and so much more for this band. Beyond that, Doug McCombs came into the band a little bit later. He's been the third kind of key member of this band since the 80s. Since then, they've had different lineups. The latest one, James Elkington on guitar, very fine guitarist, and Mark Greenberg, a longtime veteran of the studio, as well as multiple bands like the Cocktails, now a very well-respected keyboardist and recording engineer and producer, also with the band now in this latest lineup. You know, the offshoot bands from this band are incredibly impressive. I mean, Janet Bean with Freakwater,
yeah.
Doug McCombs with Tortoise, and Rizzo and 11th Dream Day have been synonymous since the 80s. The equal parts punk and Neil Young format has made them, they were sort of a, if Prairie School Freakout, their debut album, had come out a few years later, it came out in 88, it would have been right in the center of that, you know, I'm going to use that G word, grunge, it would have been right in the center of that and probably, I think, deservedly so, a big part of that scene.
Well, you know, the cliche in Chicago and nationally, I think, is that 11th Dream Day just never properly captured the zeitgeist. They were always either a little too early or too late. And this is an aside to you listeners. Greg Cott is the world's biggest 11th Dream Day fan.
No doubt about it. Well, the first major article I wrote for the Chicago Tribune was about this band. This was the band that said, I got to go to my editor and say, I want to write about this band.
Yeah.
And
that was so you owe your career to 11th Dream Day.
Pretty much. Pretty much owe my career to 11th Dream Day. And, you know, I'm sorry, it's their fault, folks. You got to blame them. Let's play a track from 11th Dream Day, Since Grazed. It's Tyrian Purple from 11th Dream Day on Sound Opinions.
I've been grounded. I've been surrounded. I have floundered. The warning sounded. The worst unbounded. I'm left astounded. But my county cedars, I'm undefeated.
That is Tyrian Purple from the new 11th Dream Day album, Since Grazed. By my count, Greg, I believe album number 14. In a very rewarding career, your fandom is not ill-placed. 11th Dream Day has never given us a bad record, and it has evolved consistently. I have to admit, I was surprised diving in to the bounty of music on this double album, as you said. Only 12 tracks, but it's a long record, and it's a slow record. This is 11th Dream Day, I think, doing Velvet Underground 3, or Tonight's the Night, mm-hmm. by Neil Young. They are largely mid-tempo, or slow. One exception, you know, late in the album, A Case to Carry On explodes with that ferocity of What If Crazy Horse was a punk band, as you said. Neil Young really explodes with the guitars right out of the gate. A lot more country lilt, a lot more mid-tempo introspection. There's a lot of talk about carrying on, about how to persevere, which, you know, if we never had a pandemic, could be 11 Dream Days' career. They have never stopped making music on their terms, even while it has never supported them. A sleeper. But if you give it 2, 3, 4 listens, it begins to suck you in. At times, it's almost orchestral in the beauty of all those instruments intertwining. Greenberg is definitely an MVP. Mm-hmm. He's become the textualist, the keyboardist, the Eno, dare I say, of the group. And really wonderful things happening with Janet and Rick Rizzo trading vocals. A really rewarding album, but don't expect to get knocked on your butt on first listen.
Yeah, although I got to say, the song we played, that Tyrian Purple song, it knocked me on my butt. The fact that this band has been together for about 40 years, really, very close to that, and still has the ability to surprise us. I wasn't expecting this kind of a record from this band. You know, usually they're pouring kerosene on the fire, and it's like, you know, let's go.
Well, I was also thinking of Eighth back in 1997, where they began to experiment with a lot of electronic textures, and I thought, ooh, 11th Dream Day still has tricks up its sleeve, and I feel just as strongly about a whole new batch of tricks on Since Grazed.
Well, the acoustic guitar, for one thing. You know, I can't recall too many acoustic guitar features in 11th Dream Day songs, but that's central to this record. Most of their albums have been, if not all, have essentially been live in the studio kind of deals. They come in, they rehearse the songs, and then they play them pretty much live to tape. This record, the COVID had something to do with it, although the bulk of it was recorded before then. Originally, Rizzo was thinking this was going to be a solo record, and then it sort of evolved into a band record with the band sort of adding pieces. And I think the time involved in making it created this more spacious feel. I think of this record as like a long exhale, and the music is breathing as well. Mm. There's space in those songs. You know, 5 of the 12 tracks are over 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
And at first you think, well, that's too long. But then you sort of, as you said, you melt into this record and you realize what they're going for. And it's kind of beautiful. The one thing I'm getting out of this record is resilience, a sense of resilience in kind of dark times, and also an appreciation. Like, I think all of us felt this during COVID, like an appreciation for what we do have, the friendships we've made. You know, it's a triumphant record for them, and maybe their quietest record, but also one of their very best.
Well, that's what we think of the new albums from Brockhampton and 11th Dream Day, but we want to know your thoughts. Tell us on our Facebook group or Patreon community, or leave a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Next, we'll share our favorite songs defined by backing vocals. That's coming up on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, brewing Chicago-inspired beers since 1988. Our friends at Goose Island have award-winning, refreshing beverages ranging from hazy IPAs to the new 312 Lemonade Shandy, only available in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
We're back. I'm Greg, he's Jim, and we're sharing our favorite songs defined by backing vocals. This episode was inspired by our conversation with Mary Clayton a few weeks ago, the background vocalist for the Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter, among other iconic tracks, many others.
Leonard Skinner, many, many, many other recordings.
And, you know, we got into a broad discussion about how unsung so many backing vocalists are. Here's a singer that basically defined one of the greatest songs of the 20th century, and not many people know her as a household name. Certainly not in the same category as Mick Jagger or Keith Richards, right?
Yeah.
In fact, that episode brought us a phone call, which we are deeply touched by.
Hi, this is Edna Wright Holt, one of the background singers from the Talking Heads movie, Stop Making Sense. The other talented, great singer, Lynn, my friend, sent me your podcast. And I wanted to shout out to Darnie Walton and tell her thank you so much for the great compliment you gave Lynn and I. Darnie, I had so much fun on that gig, I thought I was going to die. That's how much fun we had together. And also, I want to shout out to Mary Clayton. My girl, you go out there and continue to kick butt, girlfriend. Y'all rock. And thank you. Thank you, Sound Opinions, for having those great, great women on today. It made my day.
So backing vocals, really important. We thought we'd give some of our favorite examples.
Jim, you've got the first one for us, right?
I do, Mr. Cott. I was thinking about what makes great backing vocals, and one of the bands that always impressed me was R.E.M. Obviously, Michael Stipe is an incredible lead vocalist, and but I always thought that without Mike Mills and Bill Berry, the bassist and drummer harmonizing behind him, adding those layers of sound, it wouldn't have been half as great a band as it was, which is why, for me, you know, R.E.M. was done when Berry left. An incredibly inventive, very musical drummer, but also a key backing vocalist, and all four members always contributed to the songwriting. I could have played any number of R.E.M. songs, but I'm in fact going with a cover, because they really mix things up. When they recorded Superman as a track on the 1986 album Life's Rich Pageant, as we both know, we've interviewed the members of R.E.M. any number of times, all of the band members were, you know, aficionados, vinyl collectors, obsessives in the history of great rock singles, one-off bands, garage bands, the Nuggets bands. And this song was originally recorded, Superman, by a group from Beaumont, Texas, called The Click, C-L-I-Q-U-E. It was a B-side of their one and only hit, Sugar on Sunday. So you're talking obscure. You know, in retrospect, I've seen some pieces written lately about this song. It is such a bubblegum pop song, but it's got a weird message. It's about a stalker who thinks he's Superman. He knows everything. He knows what's happening. He knows that his former girlfriend doesn't really love this guy she's making it with now, and he can see right through you, because of course Superman has the X-ray vision. But to me, what makes the song are the layered backing vocals. The I am, I am, I am, one after another, the three voices, Mills singing lead, with Stipe and Berry doing the backing vocals. I think it's a great example of staggered backing vocals making the song. If it was one voice, would have never been as much fun. R.E.M., Superman.
I am, Superman, and I know what's happening.
All right, R.E.M.'s Superman, that song never fails to bring a huge smile to my face. Greg, what is your first pick?
Jim, I'm going to go to Stereolab, great band from the 90s and into the 2000s, reunited recently. I saw them at Pitchfork, and they sounded as good as ever. But one key element was missing at that Pitchfork festival, and that was Mary Hansen, the backing vocalist in the band for many years. And during their prime period in the 90s. Mary, an Australian multi-instrumentalist and vocalist who joined the band in 92 and was there for that great run of six studio albums in a row, beginning with Transient Random Noise Bursts with Announcements.
Yeah, I love that album.
And, you know, they were just a wonderful band. Mary died tragically in 2002 at the age of 36. She was riding her bicycle in London, and a truck ran into her, and you know, snuffed out a great personality. You know, she was just the perfect person for that band, because Tim Gain, the primary songwriter, was so serious and so quiet.
Yeah.
And Letitia Sadie was a brilliant singer, but also very serious.
French,
you know, political,
aloof.
Very political.
Yeah.
And Mary was just a ray of sunshine. She'd come into the room, "Hi guys, how you doing?" You know, it's kind of like giving you the and that's the way she was on stage. Her counterpoint vocals against Letitia's lead vocals were the key to the band, I think, in a lot of ways, in their sound. Her understanding of harmonies, because a lot of people think, well, harmonies is just, well, I'm repeating the song line, right? No, you're not. You're figuring out how your vocals complement what the lead singer is doing. You're not just repeating it or mimicking it. You are adding another layer, sonic layer to the song. In their case, her counterpoint vocals, a counter melody line against the main melody line was so key to all those Stereolab songs because it was kind of a rock band with avant-garde leanings. French Disco is a song where basically Letitia is saying, you know, Viva Revolution, you know, like here's the revolution that's coming at you and it's going to get you, you know.
A proud Marxist,
and
she
a
was.
Beautiful song at the same time. This like bouncy pop song, and thanks to Mary Hansen's counterpoint melody line right alongside Letitia's lead vocal. It's French Disco from Stereolab featuring the great, late Mary Hansen on Sound Opinion. That is French Disco from Stereolab with Mary Hansen on the amazing backing vocals on that track. Jim, you've got another great backing vocal track for us, right?
Yeah, we can't talk about this subject, Greg, and exclude the Beach Boys. You know, the way they took those Everly Brothers harmonies, also a shout out to them, and brought them somewhere new with a little bit of doo-wop and obviously some Beatles influence. I mean, but, you know, God, when those guys sang together. I'm going to play another cover, Sloop John B. This is a song that has always fascinated me. We did a classic album dissection of Pet Sounds a while back, and many people have said this song is sort of the one that's out of place as Brian Wilson was suffering a bit of a mental breakdown coming on and acid use and plumbing the depths of his soul. He's in love with his wife's sister while still married and the mess of emotions that he had at that moment. But I actually think Sloop John B. fits very well. This is a song, the earliest mention of it anywhere was a transcription in 1916. It had been a folk song from Nassau in the Bahamas that was finally written down in 1916. Carl Sandburg, you know, poet laureate of Chicago, included it in the Great American Song Bag in 1927. There were innumerable versions, and Brian Wilson didn't like the folk music. But Al Jardine, the bassist, did. And during the recording of Pet Sounds, suggested it to Brian. They changed the chords, messed with the lyrics a bit. Not that there's a definitive version of the lyrics. I've long been fascinated. What was the Sloop John B? Apparently, there is a ship buried in the sands off of Governor's Harbor in Nassau, an actual famous shipwreck. But there's a sense of doom and foreboding. This is the worst trip I've ever been on. You know, things are going to go wrong on this boat this time out. And I think it fits Pet Sounds very well. And the a cappella breakdown when it becomes just the Beach Boys' voices, you know, is an astounding moment in pop music backing vocals. You know, but it happens throughout. You know, there'll be a line into a fight, leave me alone, the mainsail said, and the other voices are echoing. There's this wonderful symphony, little symphonies to God, Brian Wilson said, was what Pet Sounds' goal was, you know, that is happening throughout, and it's all vocal and it's all wonderful. Sloop John B. by the Beach Boys. Song about a bad trip, but it's a pretty great trip, I've always thought, Greg.
Yes, indeed. You cannot go wrong with the Beach Boys. They made the complexity sound so easy. It never seemed like they didn't know what they were doing. They were right on all the time. Speaking of great vocalists and great backing vocalists, I've got another track for us here. Sam Cooke, the great soul vocalist out of Chicago, started out in the gospel scene. He wrote a song called Bring It On Home to Me in 62, which essentially was one of the first major songs that he wrote once he began his pop career, which was exploding at the time. He was one of the biggest artists in the world at the time. This was one of the first songs that harkened back to those gospel roots. He'd sort of not necessarily erased that background in his earlier pop songs, but had sort of moved beyond it because he didn't want to blur the lines. There was a lot of gospel folks that said, hey, you're backsliding. What are you doing, you know, leaving us for pop music? And at the same time, he thought, with pop music, I don't want to pay too much attention to those gospel roots and make people think that I'm still doing that thing that I was doing with the Soul Stirrer. But in 62, Bring It On Home to Me was very much a conscious attempt at, you know, I'm big enough now where I can do whatever I want. And, you know, really digging back down into that gospel root that he came from in on the south side of Chicago. So who does he call on for backing vocals? Well, there were a number of backing vocalists on this track, but eventually they went down to just one other voice, and that was the voice of Lou Rawls. Mm. Now, Lou Rawls went on to have an incredibly successful career as a singer in his own right after this, but at that point, he was just known as a new guy that got signed by Capitol Records. Up he hadn't really established anything. But Sam knew him back from the early 50s. When Sam left for the West Coast to go sing with the Soul Stirrers, Lou replaced him in the gospel group he was singing in Chicago. Mm. So they grew up together. They knew each other very well. Sam Cooke respected Lou Rawls, and he loved the fact that Lou's deeper voice contrasted with his higher voice. And he wanted to bring some of that into the song, as well as the call and response that any church-going gospel singer, gospel vocalist knew. Growing up in Chicago on the South Side in that era, that was your bread and butter every Sunday, and in between as well, because that's what you sang on the street corner. Bring It On Home to Me really accentuates that, and it's a marvelous give and take between Sam Cooke and his buddy Lou Rawls that turned into a massive pop hit in 1962. Sam Cooke with Lou Rawls on backing vocals, Bring It On Home to Me.
I'll give you jewelry and money too.
Sam Cooke with Lou Rawls on backing vocals, Bring It On Home to Me on Sound Opinions.
As our listeners know, you and I never claim to know everything or be the only word on anything, Greg. We love hearing from colleagues who we enjoy reading to find out what music moves them. Today we're joined by Rachel Brodsky, an LA-based culture critic for The Independent, based in the UK. Rachel, welcome to Sound Opinions. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what is your song? Tell us what your pick is.
Okay, I'm going to preface this by saying that I'm not necessarily a huge fan of this artist, despite being from the East Coast and despite being from the New York area. That said, when I got the prompt for this, I thought that Billy Joel's The Longest Time was worth discussing. I'm glad it gets a great big laugh.
Joel!
Uh-huh. No, I know, okay. I know.
You're really going to have to make the case, Rachel.
And you're right. From New York and you like
Well,
Billy
I'm
Joel.
From I'm technically from New Jersey, but I mean, it's all kind of the same after a while.
Yeah,
like,
no, I was from Jersey City, Hoboken.
Right.
Jim, she's in a New York state of mind.
A New York, come on. A New York state of mind. I had the privilege, Rachel, of being cursed out on stage in front of 22,000 people by Billy Joel, and then he repeated the voicemail lest I didn't hear it. For the unpardonable sin, apparently, I had called him an unrepentant cheese dog.
I mean,
I'm still very fond of.
You're not wrong.
No, I know.
Yeah,
you think he would own it, you know?
I mean, like, I can't defend, this isn't, like, my place to defend Billy Joel as, like, a person or even a performer. You know, this is all, and I'm not helping my case here, but, like, I do think that despite everything, he is at his best when he's doing pop music, like when he's really leaning the hardest into melody. And this song is a total homage to like the 50s and 60s doo-wop and even the 40s. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of arguments to be made that perhaps he's co-opted the sound. You know, watching back the music video for this song is a little tough because it's just a bunch of white guys like snapping their fingers while like the black janitor gets to join in at the very end. It's yeah, right. it's pretty problematic, and I didn't want to sit here and be and like start to sound like Patrick Bateman talking up Kip to be a square. That said, I do think that this song is very sticky. It's a lot of fun.
I haven't been there for the longest time. Whoa.
Do I listen to Billy Joel like on the daily? No, of course I don't.
Yeah. Okay.
So on the longest time, what's the backing vocals? Is he doing them, or does he got some singers that he brought in?
No, he does. He does all the backing vocals. That's the thing. That's the other thing. Like, I think he and his producer intended to bring in backing vocals for this doo-wop track, but he ended up doing all of them. He's kind of his own doo-wop group. For a minute,
I was just flashing on how much Lou Reed also loved doo-wop, and they were artists of a similar age. Wouldn't it be fun to see a doo-wop group where Lou Reed and Billy Joel were harmonizing?
Well, let's make it a trio. Paul Simon too. He had the same.
Oh, Paul Simon.
I don't think they could be in the same room.
I think if you're going to be an artist out in New York, you have had some street corner doo-wop.
But the black hole of those three egos getting together would have caused
there isn't a room big enough for that.
Yeah.
No, we wouldn't survive. It would be the apocalypse.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Rachel Brodsky. What a surprising take on an artist that I got to tell you, Rachel, I never expected you to pick Billy Joel. But that was the longest time. And I do kind of like when he goes back to his roots. A number of his songs draw on his upbringing as a kid fascinated with music growing up in New York City. So that was well done, Rachel. Thanks so much for being on Sound Opinions.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Now let's turn it over to our listeners. Do you have a pick for the best backing vocals in a song? Share it on our Sound Opinions discussion group on Facebook or in our Patreon community. Coming up, we've got more songs where the backing vocals take center stage. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
We're back. This week, we're sharing our favorite songs where the backing vocals are in some way the main attraction. So I've been thinking about what makes good backing vocals for a long time. And, part of it is voices blending together. And I think in rock history, you can make the argument that never have two voices blended together as well as Howard Kalin and Mark Volman, who started their career in a pop band called The Turtles, became Flo and Eddie because they couldn't really work under their own names anymore. And listen to the resume of Flo and Eddie in the 70s. They sang backing vocals, of course, for Frank Zappa. They worked with T-Rex, Bruce Springsteen, Steely Dan, Alice Cooper, Blondie, the Psychedelic Furs, the Ramones, Duran Duran, that guy John Lennon. Okay, so there are any number of Flo and Eddie songs I could have chosen, but I decided to go back to band number one, the Turtles. So the Turtles had a huge pop hit with a song called Happy Together. And then the record company wanted them to do only Happy Together part 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 29, right? Keep repeating yourselves. And being snotty hippies fighting the man, they recorded a song that they thought, if we give them another stupid pop hit like Happy Together that is so kind of offensive and obviously such a parody and a joke, they'll stop bugging us. Didn't work that way. They wrote Eleanor as the stupidest pop song they could come up with. Your looks intoxicate me, even though your folks hate me. There's no one like you, Eleanor, really. I think you're swell. You really do me well. They wound up being a hit, too. And there wasn't much longer for the Turtles after that. Although, as I said, what a career as Flo and Eddie. Listen to the way those vocals merge and come together, those two voices, Mark Volman and Howard Kalin on the choruses. It's just beautiful.
gotta think about you. I just can't live without you. I really want you, Eleanor, near me. Your looks intoxicate me. Even though your folks hate me, there's no one like you, Eleanor, really.
Eleanor, gee, I think you're swell, and you really do me well. You're my pride and joy, etc. Eleanor, can I take the time to ask you to speak?
Eleanor, purposely spelled strangely.
Yeah.
E-L-E-N-O-R-E, the Turtles. I'll forgive the Turtles. You know, they were so cool and did so much other fascinating stuff in rock history. I'll forgive them for also being horrible about their copyrights and shutting down many hip-hop acts that dared sample a Turtles song.
Yes, indeed. True enough. I want to move to Laura Nyro, one of my favorite artists of all time. One of the great songwriters of all time. And we are talking about an artist who has written songs like Wedding Bell Blues and Stone Soul Picnic, huge hits for the Fifth Dimension, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and Peter, Paul, and Mary covered And When I Die, Three Dog Night with Eli's Common, Barbara Streisand, Stoney's End, goes on and on. From 68 through 70, her songs were all over the charts. So what does she do for her fifth studio album? She makes a covers record. This is much like our new friend Billy Joel. Yeah. Paying tribute to his New York City roots, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All those soul, doo-wop, R&B songs that influenced her as a child to want to sing and to write songs. She wanted to record her versions of some of those favorites.
Mm.
She knew that she needed some backup singers who understood where she was coming from. You know, this white gal who was very influenced by soul music. So she dials up her friend Patti LaBelle, who's in this group, LaBelle.
Yeah.
LaBelle was just getting started. They weren't huge yet. But Patti, with Nona Hendricks and Sarah Dash, three of the greatest vocalists of all time in R&B, still just getting their career going, they said, sure, Laura, we'll back you up on this record. So Laura opens the record with a cover of the Shirelles' I Met Him on a Sunday.
Mm.
And she basically tells Gamble and Huff, who are producing her, who are noted for their lush production touch, she says, I want to strip everything back on this record. I don't want the big buzzers and bells sound. I want a stripped-down sound that emphasizes my vocals against these three wonderful singers. So the backing vocalists share the spotlight in a lot of ways with Laura Nyro on this record.
Well, LaBelle gets credit on the album cover even, right?
They do indeed. Yeah. And, you know, she's covering songs by Marvin Gaye and Smokey Robinson and Curtis Mayfield on this record. It's just a wonderful record. If you are not familiar with this particular record, Gonna Take a Miracle, by all means seek it out because it is wonderful. But here's the leadoff track which spotlights the interplay between Laura Nyro and the trio LaBelle. I Met Him on a Sunday as covered by Laura Nyro on Sound Opinions.
Well, I met him on a Sunday.
Ooh.
And I missed him on Monday.
Ooh.
Well, I found him on Tuesday.
Met Him on a Sunday, Laura Nyro and LaBelle, just the voices and a little bit of hand percussion. Right? I love it, Greg. I'm going to stay in the R&B realm, and how can you talk backing vocals without mentioning the Raelettes, the trio, sometimes a quartet, that backed up that guy, Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ray Charles recorded Nighttime is the Right Time only months after it first appeared on record by a pretty much forgotten bluesman named Nappy Brown, 1957. Ray ups the tempo and brings in this backing group that he had just formed, had been a girl group called The Cookies. Darlene McRae, Margie Hendrix, Patricia Lyles, and Gwendolyn Berry. And when they begin singing with Ray's recordings starting in 58, they are the Raylettes. Mm-hmm. Raylettes will come and Raylettes will go, many other people. But that first incarnation of those four women never sounded better than Nighttime is the Right Time. And this conversation is being had between these sensual, sexy voices and Ray bragging about, you know, he's gonna have fun tonight. And the women are like saying, you know, there's partly skepticism and partly like they're in for that party and partly like, yeah, and then the daytime comes after the nighttime is the right time, Ray. I just love it. There's so much unspoken in so few words. And that's what one of the things that great backing vocals do is that conversation happening throughout a song. Ray Charles and the Raylettes, Nighttime is the Right Time.
Time is the Right Time. Ray Charles and the Raylettes, man. I cannot get enough of that stuff. I just think that's just...
I know. I'm shocked that I got to height, this one and you didn't choose it.
The height of, you know, background vocals and also just interplay between a lead vocalist and background singers. I'm going to close with a David Bowie track. And, you know, David gets a lot of stick for, you know, never inventing anything, always riding coattails to create his own sound in the 70s. But he gave back to the artists that he borrowed from. Some would say he stole from them. David is very transparent about who he was taking from. And in this case, he wanted to make a soul record in the mid-70s, which became the Young Americans record. Mm-hmm. He knew that he needed some help doing this. He loved the sound. I want to get that sound. He reached out to a then relatively unknown vocalist named Luther Vandross to be his arranger on the vocal parts in this song, on the vocal parts on this album. And that's in many ways the Young Americans record hinges on those backing vocals, primarily by Vandross and Robin Clark and Ava Cherry, who worked together to create these beautiful backdrops for Bowie songs on that particular record. The title song, Vandross plays a key role. He basically set up the arrangement. There's a track that Vandross had recorded during this period called Funky Music is a Part of Me that ended up becoming the template for Fascination. Mm. And Bowie gave him a co-songwriting credit on that. So in a lot of ways, I talked to Vandross about this years later. Luther, by the way, died in 2005. Tragic early demise for one of the great singers of the last 50 years. But Vandross was very appreciative of what Bowie did for his career and how he used, you know, his skills in the recording sessions for that record. You know, he said, without David giving me a leg up, I'm not sure where my career would have gone. Mm. But he was one of those guys who sort of picked me out of the crowd and said, you know, I want to work with you. And that was a huge stepping stone in his career. And, of course, he ended up having tons of hits in the 80s and 90s. Anyway, it all began here with Young Americans, the title track from David Bowie's record, with Luther Vandross on backing vocals on Sound Opinion.
I heard the news today, oh boy.
I got a sweet and you got the
make me break down and cry.
Young Americans with a young Luther Vandross backing David Bowie. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we are going to talk with Jeff Chang, the author of the classic hip-hop history, Can't Stop, Won't Stop.
Out now in a new edition. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our intern, Sol Delgadillo.